So I'm hoping tonight that we can make this kind of a dialogue based loosely on Adyashanti's book, which I think most of you have or have looked at or have thought about looking at. It's really a gem of a book, and I found myself not feeling quite sure how to address it, because it's one of those books that you could read and reread and reread for the rest of your life and continue to get new things out of it. We've been trained primarily by Frank in the tradition of what's called in America Vipassana, which is one of the paths of inquiry, where we try to see what's going on. Ultimately, this work that we're doing together, the study and practice of the Dharma, is about waking up. And the problem is that we don't really know what waking up means. We hear this term, waking up, and we think, sounds pretty cool. I'd like to get some of that. But it's not about getting anything. It's really not really that there's anything there to get. As Adyashanti in this book really beautifully discusses, this Dharma work that we're doing together is really about unlearning. It's about unlearning what we think we should know or what we think we do know, because he points out that what we think we know blinds us to what is really going on, to things as they are. Or as Suzuki Roshi said in that handout I gave a couple weeks ago, things as it is. And I know we've talked in the past about how we come to the Dharma out of a sense of suffering, or at least dissatisfaction with how things are. If we were totally satisfied with our lives, we wouldn't be here. Although some people come simply out of curiosity. They've heard about Buddhism and want to learn something about it. And even though the Four Noble Truths points out that suffering is the core issue, Adyashanti, from his tradition, is pointing out that what we're actually involved in here is trying to wake up, waking up from the dream of our life, the illusion that keeps us locked in suffering. So it's a process of unlearning, partly because what we think we know is that everything ultimately is about us. That you could say, yes, as a matter of fact, I am the center of the universe. I am the one. Even though we never admit this publicly, we orient ourselves to all of the phenomena in the world as if that were true. So the Dharma seems difficult to believe because we have really strong habits and beliefs to the contrary. The Dharma seems difficult because letting go of our habitual attachment to this self-referential viewpoint is very scary. What would we be if we weren't ourselves? And the Dharma seems difficult because actually the truth of how things are is too simple for our ordinary habitual minds to grasp. So we reject what's in front of us, even though this is the direction that Adyashanti is slowly leading us in this book, and that Frank has been leading us in all of his teachings, to actually recognize the truth of what is all around us at all times in this moment. So we've been following a path of inquiry, the Vipassana tradition, but we make the mistake of thinking that inquiry is about figuring things out, which is a really big problem. that Frank has tried to address with us, that Ajahn Shanti is trying to address with us, and which we will be trying to address with ourselves for the rest of our lives. Habits are so strong. So Ajahn Shanti's book really is about waking up from figuring out, from figuring things out, from the illusion of control, as he puts it. His approach is really unusual in Dharma writings because it's so free of concepts. It's so free of beliefs. It's such a distillation of his experience that it's kind of breathtaking sometimes to read it in the perspective of all the other Dharma books, not to put any of them down. It's just that this is his attempt to get down to the bare bones, hoping that that would help us to understand what's being talked about. His book is really a brilliant look at waking up to a different view and a different way of life. And I hope that each of you is getting a chance or will get a chance to read it. So what he's talking about here is the things that all Dharma teachers end up talking about. That this process of waking up from our mistaken beliefs is really about slowing down and even stopping, about opening up to what is, to being silent, to being fully present, and to embrace not knowing, as Frank has taught us in different ways. Not knowing is most intimate, and Ajahn Shanti is doing his best to help us become intimate with what is, and intimate with the problem of our self-centered approach that has been a lifetime of practice and hasn't really helped us. So if we were to try to distill everything down to the essence, I think it would be fair to say that all Dharma practice is mind training. It's all about training our minds away from an habitual way of seeing and thinking and assuming and behaving, and helping us to perceive and to behave without self-reference, without assuming that I am indeed the center of the universe and that everything has to do with me and that I can control the outcome of things. So in the book, he gives a couple of quotes that I want to just repeat here. They're one-liners. He ended one of his chapters with saying, he was quoting Christ, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is spread upon the earth, and men do not see it." This could be used as a koan. It's a wonderful thing to form a question around, not a question of so much, what does this mean, a head question, but a question of sitting with it, just chewing on it. If you remember Philip Moffat's book way back, Dancing with Life, he repeated what his teacher had told him about how to study and how to deal with questions or statements or teachings or instructions. And this is a classic Buddhist approach, and I think it predated Buddhism. First you listen, or in our case, read, or if you've memorized something, you can recite it. And then you actually contemplate it. You do chew it for a bit. You turn it over, you look at it from different angles, you try to sense into it, you feel it. You do everything in your power to think and sense and feel and digest and wonder, and then you drop it. You just rest. And that three-part approach, listening or reading, contemplating in various ways and then resting is often a good way of dealing with a statement like this that will come up in the readings. And either there's a couple things that happen, either in our reading or in talks or in our practice, things will come up that we just gloss over. And it's the glossing over or the hurrying past or saying, it's interesting, I'll get back to it someday, that are actually little cues to us that we've stumbled over something that might be worth paying more attention to. These are the spots in our practice that could be called the edge of our practice, and they're the spots where inquiry can begin. So in this case, the kingdom of heaven is spread upon the earth and men do not see it, is a beautiful jumping off place for inquiry. Why did he choose to put this here? Why did he choose to quote Christ when he's supposed to be a Buddhist? Why did he think this was important enough for me to run into at this point in his instruction manual? So you ask that question, and sometimes the best way to ask questions is not of somebody else, but to ask them of ourselves. Why did he put this here? What am I supposed to get from it? One thing we can get from it is that he and all the other teachers, Suzuki Roshi and that last handout, are trying to get us to see that the truth of things, the actual message we're supposed to be getting, is already all around us. Things as they are, just this, simply this, all around us at every minute. And so this quote can be understood to be the view of another religious teacher on that same subject, that actually what we're supposed to be getting is this moment-by-moment reality of what's in front of us, seen in a different way. Another quote, just one more one-liner that I wanted to share with you from Adyashanti's book, is something his teacher would talk to him about. This is a quote from his teacher about finding, quote, the you who has no difficulty, even when you are having difficulty. Again, this could be glossed over as nonsense. It could be glossed over as something I'll get back to someday. It could be glossed over as something I'll ask Frank about someday. Or it could be used as a point of contemplation. What is he putting that quote here for? Why did his teacher bother to tell it to him, and why is he bothering to share it with us? What could he mean, the you who has no difficulty, even when you are having difficulty? And you see that one thing that comes up if you contemplate a quote like this is it reminds you of the teachings that we've received on equanimity. That waking up or seeing the truth of things does not promise us that we're going to have no difficulties in life. The Buddha didn't make that promise, and none of the teachers that I know of have made that promise. But this quote leads to a very intriguing possibility, which is that there can be a freedom in knowing the truth of things, so that even when you are encountering difficulty, that encounter is not difficult. In other words, it's possible to maintain serenity in the midst of an emotional crisis when you actually start to see what's going on. And there are real-life examples. I saw an amazing YouTube of a woman who, with her daughter, survived one of the worst of the German concentration camps, feeling happy while she was there and spending her time trying to cheer up others. So something like that would give us a hint about what Ajahn Chah's teacher might have meant, the you who has no difficulty even when you're having difficulty. And one thing Ajahn Chah talks about a lot in this book is attitude, assumptions. So the core of what we're being taught is that there is suffering and we can be free. And this getting free is a process of waking up. And the traditional teachings are that there are 84,000 ways of teaching this and 84,000 ways of practicing it. So that explains the plethora of books and teachers and retreats and everything else. Each one of us hears a little differently, has a little different frame of reference, has different receptor sites. And we'll hear from each teacher that person's own experience with the same basic issue. How do we wake up? How do we wake up from this dream of self-centeredness? How do we get to the point where we're the one who has no difficulty even while having difficulty? It's tough enough even to make sense of these things. So we're given mind training. All of these practices are different ways of training our mind to move away from this self-centered assumption, training our minds to start to recognize truths that we've never recognized before but are right under our nose. And there are a lot of different ways we've already been introduced to mind training. Frank's wonderful quote, "Welcome everything, embrace, welcome everything, push away nothing," is a practice that allows us to train our mind. And part of training our minds is watching our minds. So we watch when we don't want to embrace something, instead of just unconsciously moving the other way or ignoring it or rejecting it. We watch that, oh, this is happening. And part of that watching is remembering also, oh, I'm supposed to do something different here. Welcome everything. Sounds impossible. Push away nothing. Sometimes that sounds even more impossible. But it's a training. And sometimes all we can do is notice that we're failing. And that's huge. Because normally we're too uncomfortable, too unconscious to even notice that. So the paramitas, the perfections, are another kind of mind training. I find the six paramitas to be most handy: generosity, moral discipline, patience. Those first three of the six are all about letting go of our tight grip on ourselves. Generosity, quite a dramatic example of that. We're opening our palms and giving something that's precious to us. Moral discipline, that essentially involves not doing harm to ourselves or others. Because it turns out, over the thousands of years that people have been studying this, that when we do harm to ourselves or others, it creates a lot of obstacles. And there's enough trouble on this path. We don't have to add more. Patience, another way of reducing the edge of self-clinging. Instead of reacting impatiently, we just practice patience and see what happens. Diligence is the fourth. Joyful diligence is what we're reminded to do, just sticking with it, even though sometimes it doesn't make sense or we're tired or we don't want to. But this is another way of wearing down the edges of self-clinging, sticking with something when we don't want to. Meditation is the fifth, and Frank has been encouraging us to meditate because if nothing else, it helps us to slow down and stop and see what happens. In slowing down and stopping, we get to reflect a little bit on our habitual patterns. And then the sixth is wisdom, which is the awakening process. Wisdom arises when we can accomplish these other things. And wisdom in Buddhist teachings is inextricable with compassion. The wiser we get, inevitably the more compassionate we get. They can't be separated. So that's how the paramitas are mind training. There are other mind trainings that we've been introduced to, compassion practices, loving kindness practices. These two wear away the sharp edges of self-clinging. Mindfulness is the core of American Vipassana movement. And with mindfulness, we're learning to watch the mind and learning to see where these things come up, learning to see where we cling to self, where we don't embrace, where we do push away. Mindfulness is also part of the mind training in terms of inquiry and investigation. And if we have time, we can talk more about inquiry and investigation, but Adyashanti addresses these things in his book. Probably the most important thing to know about inquiry is it's not what we think it is. We use our mind to frame a question, and Adyashanti encourages us to frame important questions, ones that are really seeming crucial in our practice. And then not to think about the question, not to think about the answer. In fact, he makes a point in an earlier book that once you've used your mind to frame the question, you quickly drop to below the neck to find the answer. You sense into it. You see what arises. Adyashanti used to have a practice. I don't know if he still does it, but for years, he would, after meditation, go and sit in a coffee shop and take paper and pencil and promise himself that he would not write anything that wasn't absolutely for certain true, that he knew for certain would be true. And he wouldn't write even a single word until he knew for certain that it was true. And how he knew was something he described as a kinesthetic process. It's not knowing up here. He drops below the neck to find the answers. And that's something that other teachers have taught us too. So inquiry uses the whole body. We use our minds to frame a question, and then we drop into what the Buddhists would call the heart mind, the rest of the body, the body's felt experience, to see what feels true. He also points out that inquiry is not about philosophizing. That's up in the head. He says it's literally to kinesthetically hold at the boundary between what I know and what is beyond what I know. He holds himself there, and the answers arise as a felt sense, or don't. He admitted that sometimes he would sit for a very long time in front of a blank piece of paper. And then he talks a little bit in other books as well as this one about the process of investigation, which is an ancient one shared by all religious traditions, which has been called the process of subtraction, where you actually, again, use your mind to find out what it is, what a thing is not. For example, in this process of inquiry, which is another form of mind training, you might ask yourself the question, am I my thoughts? And then with this process of subtraction, you start to look at, is that possible? Could you be your thoughts? And you see that thoughts come and go and change. And things you held dearly to 20 years ago, you don't believe now. So you see that thoughts are unreliable. And you realize just through this brief exercise that your ultimate essence couldn't be thoughts, because they're just too unreliable, too impermanent, too coming and going. So that's another technique that starts with the mind, but then the answers often come from the heart. Now, I ran into one other thing. Actually, my wife, Carol, sat me down in front of a YouTube video this morning saying, before you go any further, you should watch this. And I'll recommend this to all of you. It's a TED Talk by a fellow named Sean Achor, A-C-H-O-R. It's like anchor without an N. And the title is The Happy Secret to Better Work. But what the delightful and very humorous TED Talk is all about is mind training. And he starts out really interestingly looking at how Western psychology has focused on the negative and focused on the norm, and how the news we get makes us believe that most of what's happening is bad, when in reality most of what's happening is good. So he looks at these biases, and then he looks at how in the workplace only 20% of work success can be attributed to IQ, and all the rest is attributed to attitude, positive attitude. He talks about what a positive attitude is. And then at the end, he gives us 5 mind training exercises. And I'll just repeat them now, but I really encourage you to watch that YouTube. Again, Sean Achor, The Happy Secret to Better Work. Number 1, writing down 3 new gratitudes each day for 21 days. He says, believe it or not, research shows that this does change your mind. 3 new, fresh new gratitudes every day for 21 days. Again, here's where diligence comes in, sticking with it. Second one is journaling about 1 positive experience that you've experienced in the last 24 hours. And you do that 21 days at least. 1 positive experience of the last 24 hours. You journal about it. The third one doesn't sound like mind training. It's exercise. He says that exercise is mind training because it teaches the brain that behavior matters. Again, diligence. But exercise has the beneficial effect of showing the brain that there are changes. Number 4 is meditation. And he gives several reasons why research has shown that meditation is beneficial for positive attitude, one of which is that it overcomes what he calls cultural ADHD. And then last but not least, random acts of kindness. So mind training takes many forms, from forms that can appear dry or academic, all the way to forms that appear kind of silly and fun. But what we're trying to do is train our mind to perceive and behave in non-habitual ways so that we can expand our arena and start to recognize truths that we've never recognized before. So I think it's a brilliant book. I think it's worth spending time with. I know that many of you don't have much time to spend, but I would certainly encourage what you can. Even tiny little bites at a time over the course of a year or so. Now, I was hoping that either based on the book or practice or past experiences, there might be some questions either written down or spontaneous that we could use to kind of flesh out this really, really brief and butchered summary of what Ajahn Shanti is trying to share with us. Gina, were there any written questions? So let me make sure I understand the question. What you're saying, I think, is that as you're emptying out in meditation and practice, you're having more curiosity.
Yes.
That your attempts to get below the neck and have a felt experience have been difficult, but that what you're noticing is that curiosity is leading to a sense of warm love. Looking forward to what would be previously a difficult experience is a sign of success, really. So you're reminding me very much of the things that were talked about in this TED Talk that I just mentioned. You're also reminding me of the intimacy of not knowing, that curiosity is related to not knowing, and that this warm love you're describing could be a manifestation of the intimacy that comes from curiosity and not knowing.
That word fits.
Yeah. So congratulations. You're really embodying something that Frank is taught on and that Ajahn Shanti is teaching on, and that is really the heart of inquiry. You're opening. In the opening is coming a not knowing. By the way, Ajahn Shanti says that the best answers that he gets to the questions he asks himself are the answers of not knowing. When he just doesn't know, he experiences the opening. And from the opening, he experiences the kinesthetic sense, eventually, of some kind of response. And you're describing that whole step-by-step process just beautifully. So I think, wow, whatever practice you're doing is bearing fruit. Yeah, that's wonderful. And it's one of the best living examples I've seen of the benefit of not knowing. We can read about it, but to actually bear witness to how not knowing leads to curiosity, and curiosity leads to this openness and this warmth and this love, also reminds me of how it is that compassion and wisdom are not separable. I'm assuming then from what you're saying that there's something in your life which gives you a choice, really, between simply being with the pure experience of it and seeing what that leads to, or going into what for most of us is an habitual response of trying to interpret what's going on. You know, the human dilemma. No matter how much we study and practice, we have to realize that we will get really caught up in a life drama when it unfolds, because our entire life has been training for that drama and training to be completely swept up by it and training to not be able to let it go. There's an old teaching that there are four major obstacles. One is intellectual, thinking things through. One is emotional, getting swept up by the emotions. One is just the plain karma we deal with, being in this body at this time in this place. And the fourth is habit, the force of habit. And the teaching is that habit is the hardest to overcome, that we can even overcome karma, some of the mutable karma to some extent, before we can overcome habit. So I think one thing I could say is that a lot of forgiveness and self-tolerance is needed at a time when there's a drama going on in our life. Because no matter what we've read we should do, or what we think we should do, or what people have told us we should do, we'll get caught up in it. And that is the human condition, number one. But it's also the truth of what's arising. Let's go back for just a second to that quote, "The kingdom of God is spread upon the world and men do not see it." I suppose he means women don't see it either. I like to think that anyway. Don't want the tables tilted too strongly. But so anyway, part of our not seeing is our selection bias. We want to choose things that are good and pleasant and reject things that aren't. We do not want to welcome everything and push away nothing. But actually, the kingdom of heaven is everything that is presented to us, not only the pain and the drama and the events themselves, but also our painful responses. And this is where the chief part of mind training comes in, watching what arises in us. And so when Frank reminds us to welcome everything, the koan at that moment is, what can I learn from watching what I'm doing here? What can I learn from watching how I get swept up in this? What can I learn from how I instantly go to analyzing and trying to fix? Adyashanti reminds us repeatedly in this book about the illusion of control, that part of our self-centeredness is believing that we can control things and how that's part of our suffering. So in the case of being swept up, we can watch what's happening and reflect on how we are in our attempts to get rid of pain, actually wedding ourselves to it. Now, I've assumed a lot without going into your story at all. Partly it's for privacy, and partly it's for trying to fit the time we have tonight. But we're all looking for the person who'll tell us about our decision. But behind the curtain, the process that's going on is the edge of our practice. So behind the surface of your conflict, behind the wanting to know if you made the right decision, is a playing out of the drama of trying to control and trying to be certain. Not that these are wrong, not that we can even help doing it. And actually, the circumstances of our lives often depend on our making some good decisions. So I'm not trying to in any way imply that you shouldn't go ahead and try to solve problems in your life. But can you look at the process, just even a half step removed, to find, as Adyashanti's teacher would advise him, the you that has no difficulty even while you're having difficulty? So let me just use this as a moment, and thank you so much for bringing this up, because it's crucial. It's really where the rubber hits the road, where our practice hits real life. And Adyashanti would take a teacher, question like his teacher asked, can you find the you who has no difficulty even while you are having difficulty? And he would sit with that in this case, not trying to find an answer that somebody else would approve, but in this case, dropping below the neck and seeing, is it actually possible to find the you who has no difficulty even when you are having difficulty? And he would then, after some time, come upon the fact that he just does not know. Pure and simple. He does not know how to answer that question. And that's where the opening started for him. And that's where the opening starts in the ways that many other teachers talk about. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to solve the question, the problem. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't seek advice. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to use your good mind to solve what problems you can. But at the same time, or as a parallel process, you can follow Ajahn Shanti's teacher's advice. Can you find the you that has no difficulty, even while you are having difficulty? And you can contemplate that, and then you can rest. And if you're like Ajahn Shanti, the answer that will come up is that you have no idea what that means or how to do it. And that no idea is an opening and an intimacy out of which some new truth can possibly arise. Now, he's quick to point out that if you chase after it, you will chase it away. It's really an opening, the opening of not knowing. So, good luck. And don't hesitate to ask friends and get help and use your skills, but do this other thing on the side and see what arises.
Okay, thank you.
So we're out of time again. I'm trying to keep us on schedule. And there may be some things we've talked about tonight that might spark some curiosity or opening, or might seem like they're right, or they might seem that they're wrong. Whether these things seem right or wrong, part of mind training would be to sit with that, to notice that you're having a reaction to something. That reaction itself is a hint that there's some movement there, some potential there. And so chew it over, contemplate it, frame a question about it, and then drop below the neck, rest, and see what arises. And if you're really, really fortunate, what will arise is that you have no idea what it means. And in that no idea, there's some great potential. Okay, well, Frank is still in Bali. He actually posted a wonderful thing from Allen Ginsberg, if you haven't had a chance to look at it. Allen Ginsberg wrote a couple of poems about meditation, and this is an excerpt from one of them. And then on the 30th, Wednesday, I guess it's the 30th, I'll be meeting with you again for another Skype, and then in February, Frank will come back and resume talking with us. It's a great pleasure to see you all again and to be with you. I really miss being there in person.